Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
It's an opportunity a year into the Russian invasion of Ukraine to review both where we are at the present moment and how earlier predictions looked. What I don't want to do, because time is limited, is simply repeat, still less, read out what I wrote and which was published on the Critic website within the last 2 weeks, a website that I recommend people looking at because it does have a lot of pertinent and up-to-date things. And in that, I made a number of reflections, which I think are valid, partly because, and this is where I want to take further in this instance, I argued that although there has been this temptation to suggest that the defeat of Russia, or the defeat last year of Russia, one should say, represented a new age of warfare, from the perspective of somebody who writes on the history of war, as opposed to somebody who, as it were, just decided 5 minutes ago that they wish to pontificate, from that perspective, this appears less clear-cut. So what I want to first do is to look at some specific points about 2022 and the start of the war. Then I want to try and discuss longer term continuities. Then I want to say a bit about where we are at the present moment. And then I want to try and offer one or two reflections on the future. So that's the order of things. Let's start off with some comments on the extent to which the early stages of the war represented quite clearly a failure for Russia, the hopes it held for a rapid victory of the type of which it had seen when it conquered Hungary in 1956, or when it suppressed the Prague Spring, or indeed when it beat up Georgia in the post-communist days. None of those were going to be repeated. And there was, I think it's fair to say, a degree of genuine pleasure about Russia's defeat. Obviously, we're all aware that at every stage we're talking about real human beings being killed, both Ukrainian and Russian. But I think it's fair to say there was a general pleasure that the aggressor had been defeated at that stage. I think it's also worth pointing out, and this will come to in the strategic sense when we're looking at the war, that in terms of broader habits of war avoidance, the beginning of the war also represented a failure for deterrence, in the sense that intelligence of what the Russians were preparing, certainly of large-scale military preparations with the prospect of an invasion of Ukraine, were widely disseminated, particularly but not only, by Britain and the United States, with good real-time intelligence, and attempts were made by a number of governments, including the British government, to urge the Russians not to invade. And in that context, what is quite clear is that there was a failure of deterrence, a failure, if you like, both of military deterrence and of diplomatic means. And that obviously is of consequence if we're looking to the future, because one of the challenges of this episode, specifically about Russia, but also including other potential aggressor powers, such as, and this in no way exhausts the list, unfortunately, but particularly China, North Korea, or Iran, that in a sense, the failure of deterrence is the most important part of the strategic situation, how that changed last year. And it is by no means clear that even the failure of Russia to overthrow Ukraine last year has, as it were, compensated for the failure of deterrence. One's looking there at issues at different levels of order, as it were, but they're both can be put in the same equation. So that's point number one. Point number two, I made reference to the longer term nature of military history. Well, there's two issues I think we should emphasize here. At first, that there are structural problems in Russian and prior to that Soviet doctrine and operational and tactical employment and process. Precisely because we fortunately did not see World War III, we didn't have the opportunity of understanding what those might have meant in terms of a conflict with NATO. But the use of Russian advisors and Russian equipment did not prevent a whole host of serious defeats, in some cases disasters, for Russian allies, whether we're thinking of the Libyan invasions of Chad, the Syrian invasion of Jordan in 1970, Syrian and Egyptian attacks on Israel in 1973, the Iraqi attack on Iran in 1980, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and its aftermath in 1991, and then again in 2003. We can go on. These do not exhaust it by any means. But what is clear is that factors that people saw operating with the Russians in Ukraine, to wit, a degree of a rather static, deliberative form of warfare, which left Russian units vulnerable to lighter but more agile opponents, as in, for example, the so-called Toyota War in Chad, in which opponents operating out of the back of Toyotas were able to defeat significant forces of Soviet armor. Or one might think of the Soviet failure in Afghanistan in the early 80s, 1979 to 1988, where again, opponents who lacked the same degree of equipment, but also were more agile in their conceptualization of war, proved very able to check or at least lessen the rate of Soviet success. So I think that helps to underline the fact that we are not talking about a new phenomenon in Ukraine. I think this is a very important point. And indeed, if one is looking for a historical antecedent, I would have thought the most obvious historical antecedent were the heavy defeats the Finns imposed on the Soviet forces in 1939, in the opening months of the so-called Winter War of 1939 to 1940. So this is not new, and precisely because it is not new, it does not have to be explained in terms of new technology or new organizational methods. Indeed, one can take that a stage further by arguing that when you get a new weapon or a new weapons system or a new weapons platform, and we can discuss drones in that context, they work most effectively when they can be integrated into pre-existing patterns and when people can be trained for them adequately. But as standalones, as it were, a silver bullet to transform the nature of war, they are very rarely as successful as people might envisage. This may be counterintuitive. And there is the Clint Eastwood film in which, of course, the villain says the man with the Winchester always wins, just for the benefit of listeners who are not American. A Winchester was a repeating rifle, a very effective piece of mid-19th century kit. Well, of course, If you know the film, you'll know that the man with the Winchester, who was the baddie, didn't defeat Clint Eastwood, who had the much less effective weapon, because Clint Eastwood outthought him. Now, this again shouldn't surprise us. War is by its very nature a complex phenomenon in which at the tactical, operational and strategic level, there are a whole host of variables. The tactical level, one might think in particular of unit cohesion, morale, leadership, an understanding of the terrain, etc., etc., none of which are necessarily harmed by having a better weapon, whatever you mean by a better weapon in this context, but nor are they necessarily insured by having such a weapon. So in other words, it's not surprising, should not be surprising to us, that you do not need to explain the outcome of what happened last year in terms of the particular technology that was enjoyed by Ukrainians as opposed to Russians. What you should, you know, people have talked about Elon Musk and techno communications. Well, you may recall, those of you who are familiar with war, that about the same sorts of things were said repeatedly during the course of developments in artillery command systems over the last 150 years, and doubtless they will go on being said over the next 150 years. So that, I think, is point number two, that one must be wary about people who have tried to argue that a revolutionary or new aspect of war is occurring. And linked to that, of course, one should instead focus on what in many respects are very traditional forms of warfare and issues in warfare. For the Russians, there was in particular the problem that they sought to suppress people who did not wish to be ruled by them and who were willing to risk their lives to stop that. And this is an extraordinarily important facet because it meant that Russia was at war not just with a military, but also with an entire civil society and a resilient civil society willing to take casualties. And the Russians hadn't really thought through, other than by their habitual use of terror, how to, in some respects, suppress or intimidate that civil society. Incidentally, not that I'm suggesting any equivalence, but just as an observation, it is by no means clear to me that when you get some Ukrainian politicians, leaders, calling for, as they see it, the conquest or reconquest in their terms of Crimea or the eastern Donbass, that they aren't actually thinking, they aren't, as it were, sufficiently aware that the similar problems may not also arise, as it were, to their disadvantage. But that's another issue. So one has a traditional element in that broader question of the relationship with civil society. One has traditional elements in terms of the problems of running combined arms operations. One has traditional elements in terms of the problems of securing sufficient supplies support one's forces, particularly artillery and mechanized forces. One has the degree to which forces and their equipment suffer from and are affected by stress and strain, etc., etc. And in the case of Ukraine, of course, you have the particular challenges of the environment in terms of, depending upon which season of the year one's looking at, cold, ice, mud, thaw, dust and heat. So it's not the easiest of military environments, although there is a lot of open ground as well, and the forest cover is relatively modest. Now, we can then move on to look at the question of where we are now, and then we can consider where we might go in the future. And then Graham's going to helpfully sort of add in his points. Where we are at the present moment, and whether we can have historical background, is of course a difficult one. In some respects, we are confronting a struggle between two combatants, both of whom are determined, one of whom, the one that, as it were, is weaker in terms of its resource base and as a consequence of its economic decline under the pressure of war and under the pressure of seizures by its opponents, one of which is helped enormously by being able to call on the support, not the unconditional or full support, but the support of a large alliance body. Whereas its opponent, Russia, can get support, receive support, for example, from Iran, but those powers that are aligned with it, China being the most obvious one, are wary of playing a comparable role. Although, again, we have to be careful about being confident on that head. And that's an important point, because it may well be that in the post-war or end-of-war stage, one of the principal players will be either directly or indirectly, as a result possibly of pressure it might bring on Taiwan, the People's Republic of China. So there is that element at this stage. It's by no means clear how, if there was to be a resumption of attack, how the Russians would be able, even if they can go on inflicting pain and misery on Ukraine, as they would doubtless intend to do, it is by no means clear how they would actually be able to defeat their opponent sufficiently to lead their opponent to come to what the Russians would regard as terms that President Putin could accept. In other words, even if the use of large-scale additional conscripts, most of whom, of course, are poorly trained, even if the deployment of the full range of Russian non-nuclear air power, even if the fact that the Russian economy has done well with the higher price of fuel and that they have resources, even with all of these factors, even if they could open a front from Belarus, it's by no means clear how they would actually be able to achieve what we might imagine would be the goals that they set themselves last year at the outset. Now, what one can only assume, and one has to be cautious about ascribing rationality to one's opponents, and President Putin is an example of a paranoid personality, and one has to be very cautious about ascribing rationality to him. But what one has to be cautious about is to assume that they're still in the same position they were in last year, and it may well be that what they wish to do is inflict sufficient pain and damage that it is possible to come to a negotiated outcome, one of exhaustion, and maybe one in which a retreat from some of their gains can be provided for on the basis of the then, as it were, ending the war and waiting for the pressures to put more of the difficulties on their opponent. We don't know. That, though, could be the scenario that President Putin wishes to have, with sufficient success obtained that he can proclaim a victory, even if that is the very opposite of what he has in fact done. I mean, he's seized territory, particularly and significantly territory to the north of the Sea of Azov, which gives him the so-called land bridge. And that, indeed, it's very difficult to see how the Ukrainians propose to get it back. And that then takes us to the next element. Even if the Ukrainians could regain territory from which was clearly, as it were, Ukrainian majority territory, however you wish to define majority, prior to the war, but from which many people have fled, perforce necessarily so, even if one could regain that territory, it's not precisely clear how the Ukrainians envisage regaining, in their eyes, the Crimea and the eastern Donbass. And nor is it clear that that itself would be an outcome that would be easy to secure. So that is also an issue that in some respects one has the classic instance at this stage in a conflict. Most people have the rather naive view that war is won. You could argue President Putin had this naive view that war is won when you occupy your opponent's capital and you then defeat their armies, and that's it. A kind of 1945 for Germany, or 2003 for Iraq. Well, of course, that isn't it. I mean, a lot is dependent on persuading your opponents to accept your will and to accept that they've lost, which was successful in the case of Germany and Japan in 1945, not successful in the case of Iraq in 2003. And I would have thought by now it's obvious that Russia has failed in that task. And that it doesn't really have a clear path forward, however much military pressure it could exert. But it's also by no means clear that Ukraine isn't outside the same issue and problem insofar as it's concerned about Crimea and the eastern Donbass. So those points are worthy of consideration. And then there is the broader strategic parameter. The most important aspect of this strategic parameter is the United States. One could argue that last year, with the American midterms in prospect, and at that stage, a unpopular president, and presidents usually do badly in the midterms, an unpopular president being challenged, you could argue that Putin had actually game played it rather effectively in his assumption, or a assumption, that a sort of nativist, isolationist, anti-NATO success for Trump in the American midterms, in the sense of Trump's America First candidates, would have led to a diminution of support for Ukraine, would have led to a crisis within NATO as people feared what might happen in the next presidential election, and therefore might have led to a diplomatic and or military solution that worked at least in part for the Russians. Well, it didn't happen. And you could argue that the most important a consequence of last year, of the midterms, was its consequence for the situation in Ukraine. Just as if Britain is a much more minor power, but if you're looking at Britain, you could argue that in terms of support, which we played an important role in both providing support and encouraging others to provide support within the NATO context, that in the British case, the key element actually occurred before the conflict started, which was the defeat of Jeremy Corbyn in the 2019 general election, because Corbyn's approach on international relations, on alliance with America, and on Russia was one that, shall we say, would have been regarded during the Cold War as that of a quite clear fellow traveller. He seems to have moved, as with so many of those people, as with, for example, the leadership or some of the leaders of the RMD, from being pro-communist Soviet Union to being pro-Russian, even though Russia at the present moment is not only not communist, it also has a kind of fascistic sort of race, religion, aspect to its politics, which really should make those on the left wonder what the hell they think they're doing, lending support to President Putin. And, you know, one can argue, in other words, that what one has got It's an international situation that deteriorated from the Russian point of view in the last months of 2022. On the other hand, there are so many imponderables, not least the possible consequences for American priorities, were there to be an escalation in tension in East Asia, either originating from China or originating from North Korea, because the crisis in Ukraine provides North Korea opportunities for, well, rocket rattling, I think. I don't think one would use the term saber rattling anymore. So given that these strategic parameters, it becomes less helpful to think about what might or might not happen on a specific battlefield in Ukraine, as though that is going to determine the outcome. Clearly, the resolution of Ukrainians, the adaptive, innovative, and skillful way in which they fight is absolutely crucial. There's no two ways about that. But it, to be effective, has to be part of a broader strategic set of possibilities, which are at play at the moment, but where they may go next year is far less clear.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. We're at the first anniversary of Russia's invasion. A new Russian offensive is brewing, may even have begun. There's a lot of talk about how Russia has learned or is learning, albeit through hard experience, from its failures a year ago. I wonder, what is it that you think it's learned or is learning?
Well, I think that we may be, if you're looking for a historical antecedent, and I mentioned Finland, we may well be in the second stage of the Finnish war. Indeed, I think it's fair to say that we might have been further along that were it not for the winter enforced lull. And that was, as you know, that in place of the broad attacks across a very wide front of the Finnish border, the Soviets focused on the main Finnish line, the Mannerheim line, and sort of a defensive line in the Karelian Isthmus, and used heavy artillery techniques to smash through. And that put sufficient pressure on the Finns that the Finns negotiated a settlement rather than have the Soviets actually occupy more of Finland. And indeed, most of Finland was not occupied by the Soviet Union, but that Finland went for a while into the Soviet bloc, though, of course, then in 1941, the Finns joined the Germans in attacking the Soviet Union at the time of Operation Barbarossa. So it really was a Pyrrhic victory for the Soviets. So I think that in a way, if I was a Soviet policymaker, what I would say is, and one assumes that you can't put a bullet through the back of President Putin's head, which would have been the most sensible way for a Soviet military policy to move forward. But if you can't do that, or you don't want to do that, then I would have thought that your obvious temptation must be to encourage the North Koreans and the Chinese to be more volatile, to do the same in the Balkans, where there are a number of pressure points that are worrying NATO. And that in the meantime, to go on relying on heavy artillery tactics and a deliberate, as it were, sort of small snatch and grab approach, rather like, in a sense, the later stages of the Somme offensive in 1916 and the later stages of the Passchendaele offensive in 1917, rather than a big, bold offensive that can go wrong.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of talk, rather hasty talk, back in February last year about, you know, the failure of tanks, and even even some commentators suggesting that this was the end of the main battle tank, is being superseded by anti-tank missile technology, handheld technology, drones, and so on. And yet here we are now with a race to reinforce the Ukrainian forces with tanks. Was that initial thinking wrong? And if it was wrong, why did the superiority in numbers of Russian tanks not have a greater effect, particularly given that much of the terrain was relatively suitable for tanks in ways in which previous Russian wars, Afghanistan and Chechnya and so on, the terrain was much more difficult for heavy armor.
Yes. Well, as you may know, I got a book published on the history of tank warfare, which Indiana University Press published, and I include at the end of that a discussion of the future or otherwise of the tank. I think what I would argue is go right back to where we started off today. The tank can be useful in some context, but one has to be wary with any particular arm, whether one's thinking of tanks, or aircraft, artillery, whatever, in assuming that it can change the parameters. So tanks at the moment are vulnerable in some contexts. On the other hand, they do provide troops with mobility and firepower. And if you think of a tank in a more broad sense of a protected and armed military vehicle, so that in a sense a heavy armored car could be seen in that context, one can possibly be better able to see that point. The major disadvantage of tanks is not just a terrain one, which you correctly identify. It's not just that they can, as is entirely to be expected, be outfought or outmaneuvered by forces that are using a combined armed system and or are more adaptive of exploiting the flanks, the unprotected flanks of their opponents, which happened with the Russian advance on Kiev. But also, and this affects both sides, putative sides in this war, I say putative because one's thinking here of NATO as being implicitly on the Ukrainian side, which is their cost. And they are expensive. And what we have, and I would argue you can see this as well as our with aircraft, you could say, I would say, I've argued this in my book on air power, that we had an apex in the effectiveness to a degree of both aircraft and armor in the middle decades of the 20th century, because at that stage they were relatively inexpensive to operate, relatively easy to use, so training was low, relatively easy to maintain, and you could afford to have a lot of them. Now, you could argue that what has happened since then is that chasing high specs, high specification outcomes has pushed up the complexity of these systems, has led to their cost, both in procurement and maintenance, being much, much greater, has therefore meant that you have fewer of them, and therefore meant that they become, as it were, their maintenance becomes, as it were, almost an operation, well, a tactical, operational, and strategic incubus, that, you can't, as it were, risk the loss of 10 tanks, something like that. And I certainly think that that is a part of what we're talking about. But from the Ukrainian point of view, the supply of tanks is valuable because tanks provide a form of mobile artillery. In many senses, what one's thinking of here is the doctrine and practice of the self-propelled gun, and that is more useful than the tank as tank killer, which is another aspect of the tank. Because you have to remember, when people talk about the tank, they're talking about a type that has varied specifications, varied purposes, and it can be very misleading to compare them as if it's like for like. It isn't that case. But from the Ukrainian point of view, it also represents a way to get a public commitment out of, in particular, Germany, which was designed to send a message to Russia. And that was obviously significant because prior to the war, the major strategic and geopolitical alignment within the European Union was that of France and Germany. And France in particular, but also Germany, saw themselves as powers that should have a strategic partnership with Russia. Both of those powers had acted to thwart Britain and the United States when President George W. Bush wanted Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. And that in a sense, sending a very clear message by the provision of tanks is a valuable one. I mean, obviously, in some respects, it would be nicer to have troops, but nobody really envisages the Germans or the French sending troops to Ukraine. So materiel is the next best thing.
Mm-hmm. Finally, I'd like to ask about the difficulties of the data that analysts have in assessing what's going on. I mean, we see every day maps of Ukraine in different colors showing the 15 to 20% or so which is in under Russian occupation. So we're following almost in real time the little micro movements on the map, almost like the Western Front in the First World War, where there are little gains here or losses there. But we're not getting a very clear picture on the scale of casualties. Russian claims and Ukrainian claims simply don't, they're not even in the same ballpark. They don't marry at all. And, even the best efforts to find out the rates of human attrition on both sides is fraught with difficulty. And also the wider attrition of materiel. I mean, First World War style, there's talk of Ukraine heading towards a shell crisis. It's using up shells more quickly than its Western suppliers can support it with. And yet we don't really have a clear kind of data set on how significant these shortfalls are. Are there any hints that you can see, does it really mean we're all slightly in the dark as to what's the real state of play?
Well, that's a fascinating question. There are several things to say. First of all, by the way, there is clearly logistical strain, particularly for Ukraine, but also for Russia, but particularly for Ukraine, which makes their effort even more impressive. As far as casualties are concerned, I think one can fairly say that you tend to get more reliable casualties figures coming out of a democracy, which allows in war correspondence, which is the situation with Ukraine, than a dictatorship, which is what Russia in practice is, whatever the elections they hold, which controls the news. So you would be reliant more on Ukrainian statistics, but obviously both sides are using statistics in part in order to convince the wider world and their own domestic opinion of the strength of their activity. Now, if you go on to data, the data that is available in some respects is excellent in the sense that the kind of satellite reconnaissance that would have really helped people in World War II, maybe seeing the Japanese fleet approaching Hawaii, is just, it's a totally different ball game. And of course, the Chinese with their balloon over America have emphasized to just about everybody the value of having real-time intelligence, real-time in the sense that you have transmission systems that can pass on electronic and visual records at once, which is really very, very significant. On the other hand, you have the classic problem which you've always had, particularly with a dictatorial system, which is to try and understand the prioritization that they are placing on matters and what their game plan is. And here you've got real difficulties, the lack of or weakness of human intelligence information sources within these regimes. And I think it's fair to say that although there is a lot of murderous incoherence within the Soviet, North Korean, Chinese, and Iranian regimes, there isn't the absolute dysfunctionality you've got within the German one during World War II, in which there were, you know, rival intelligence services, in which one of them, at least the Abwehr, had links with the British, and so on and so forth. So I think what one's got here is a real difficulty. And if I might give an example of this, you know, part of this is the problem with modern military history. If you think about military history of the Soviet Union, most British readers will be familiar with a book like Anthony Beevor's Stalingrad, which is pretty good. I mean, he doesn't know Russian, but he paid a Russian translator. But it's pretty good on face of battle stuff, which is what war correspondents tend to focus on at the present moment. But it's absolutely hopeless at looking at prioritization and planning in by Stalin and around Stalin during that process. And I think it's fair to say that that remains a weakness of a lot of the literature on the Eastern Front in World War II. And the focus which we've seen since John Keegan's work on the face of battle in the 1970s, on the face of battle, apart from telling us you the obvious points, that war can be horrible, it can be exciting, it can be frightening, that people are motivated primarily by what their mates think about them, etc., etc. You know, so what? We know all that. If you're actually concerned with what is the are the operational and strategic priorities and parameters at a specific point, and how are they perceived by opposing decision makers, that's the key thing that you want to understand in war. And that is very difficult if you don't have a means of penetrating the opposing high command. So we're pushed back into the vital strategic environment of trying to interpret often quite scanty intelligence information, or looked at differently, a mass of intelligence information that isn't scanty in the terms of really reliable material at the very highest of levels. And that's why it is difficult to say how well X or Y is doing, because you don't actually know what X or Y envisages and wants at that particular moment. We can assume that President Putin remains ambitious, that he remains deadly, that his intentions remain not only extraordinarily hostile towards his neighbours, but that more generally he isn't interested in a rules-based system of international relations. But how one can move from that to assessing what he is likely to do, as it were, on August the 1st or November the 3rd, is a very different pattern of analysis.
Well, Professor Black, there's so much instant analysis going on at the moment. It's very useful to have your historically informed, rather deeper sense of things. For taking us through where we are and what we're learning about modern warfare through the war in Ukraine, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Colleagues, friends might be interested in my military strategy, A Global History, which is published by Yale. And that includes the situation at the present and some suggestions about the future. But of course, the future is non-linear, which means, another polite way of saying, we don't bloody well know. Thank you very much.
Indeed we don't. Thank you very much, Professor Black.